This is a message that Bill, come on Bill, give him a hand, that's fine. For those of you that haven't been introduced to Bill, you weren't here this morning, he spoke on Islam tonight. He's going to speak on something that's very near and dear to his heart and has a lot to say to us. I'm just going to let you go so we can maximize that time.
Good evening. Let's pray. Father, again, thanks for your love and your mercy and your grace. And Lord, we just ask that this evening would honor you, that everything we say and do would honor you. And we pray for people around us, Father. We pray for our families and our coworkers and our neighbors who don't know you. Many times are very bitter against you, Father. Or under the deception of the evil one, Father. So many things going on. We just ask that you would give us a heart for them and you would help us reach out to them. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Is it possible, Dan? Since you're just in the neighborhood here, can we kill that thing a little? Because that one's going to drive me crazy. Some kid's got a rock. You can just take that one right out. It'd be all right with me. Oh, you've got some kids that would do that. I want to talk to you guys right now. This morning we talked about Islam. For those of you that weren't here this morning, too bad. You'll have to get the tape. No, I'm just kidding. There's a Islam is a small portion of our culture and a small portion of our at least at our ministry, at Haven Ministry, it's a small part of what we deal with. We do deal, if you're not familiar with what I said this morning about Haven Ministries works with people in non-Christian religions. So we talk to Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims, and we talk to witches, and we talk to Scientologists and the Baha'i and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and all sorts of little groups you've never heard of. Again, part of our witness is to Muslims and to the Baha'i, to related groups, to Islam. But a much larger part of our witness has been to what I call, generically, pagan America. If you've been raised in America, if you are of a certain generation, this is going to be hard for you to hear. Because a whole lot of people, a lot of our supporting churches, and where I used to be a youth pastor in the Midwest, and for a whole lot of people out there, their sensibilities of what makes America, America, is related to the fact that America is a Judeo-Christian culture. And I think you can argue in many ways that once was true, but I'm here to argue that it's completely different. I argue that today America is a very pagan culture, and I'll explain that in just a minute. About 10 years ago, the National Association of Evangelicals put out a little booklet about America. And in that book, they argued, again, our mission, at the time I was with the Conservative Baptist Missions, they gave that to all the missionaries because it was good things to look at. They argued that America was now the fourth largest pagan culture in the world, which again, to the average churchgoer, was stunning. Aren't we a Christian culture? Aren't we the ones who send missionaries out? Well, one of the statistics they point out is that, yes, America is the number one sending country of missionaries in the world. That perfectly fits our sensibilities about ourselves. But the other thing that they pointed out that did not fit that sensibility is that America is now the number two receiving country for missionaries. Only Brazil has more missionaries sent to it than America does, which ought to tell you something about how others in the world see us, that we are in dire need of missionaries, and I have a hard time arguing with you. When I say pagan, I'm using it as a generic term. It was an old Roman word for country hick, and at a certain point in history, it became the word that Christians used for non-Christians. It was still meant in a derogatory fashion. It was somebody who worshiped the world. Somebody who worshiped the things in the world. So an idolater would be a synonym for it. To most of the people I talk to today, many of them call themselves neo-pagans. They don't see it as a derogatory term. They see it as a great thing. We are not like you Christians. We are neo-pagan. We are goddess worshipers. We are New Agers, although you don't hear that term as much anymore. We are into witchcraft. We are into just spirituality. If you talk to a Shirley MacLaine or somebody like, for many of you older folks in here, Shirley MacLaine was kind of the Pied Piper, the Billy Graham, as it were, of the New Age 20 years ago. And you don't hear much about her anymore. But if you had talked to her even as far back as 12, 13 years ago, she would say, well, I'm not a New Ager. Because most of the people who had identified themselves as New Agers, like Shirley and others like that, had basically felt the heat from jokes from Leno or Johnny Carson or people like this. And by 1994, I couldn't find anybody that calls himself a New Ager. The beliefs hadn't changed, but everybody was into what's called spirituality. And you have your spirituality. I have my spirituality. Everybody has spirituality except for those religious people. And that's guess who. And the biggest part of our ministry for many years now has been going to psychic fairs, going to New Age bookstores, going to different events. I was at something 13 years ago called the Parliament of World Religions, which is the largest collection in its time. It was the largest collection of world religious leaders in history. There had never been anything like it. The Dalai Lama, Cardinal Bernardin, people from every possible religion you can think of, as well as literally hundreds of academics from Oxford to Cal Berkeley to the University of Chicago. It was just a huge collection. Cults that I had never even imagined I would ever meet. Groups from India like the Jains were there. The only cult I can think of that's American-born was the Jehovah's Witnesses. They stowed away, but virtually everybody else was there. And for somebody like me who likes to witness to lots of interesting folks, it was just wonderful. Every 10 feet was a whole new universe with a whole new understanding of the planet and all the other planets and zillions of alternate universes. You had to be dead not to be able to witness to a few people there. But anyways, this has been the biggest part of what we've done at Haven Ministries for many years now. And our message tonight is called How to Reach a Pagan World. So how is it we reach out to our friends and neighbors? Let me give you one clue here. 99% of the people I've talked to for the last 15 years who are now psychics, who are now astrologers, who are called witches, goddess worships, whatever you want to call them, used to be Baptist, used to be Presbyterian, Free Church, Pentecostal, Catholic, you name it. Two atheists in 15 years, a handful of Jews, and virtually every other person I've ever talked to in these places was raised in a Christian church of some sort, without fail. And I rarely read a person who says, well, I read the Bible, and I read the Bhagavad Gita, and I just like the Bhagavad Gita better. I almost never have that conversation. What I usually hear is a horror story about us. Oh, yeah, we were raised Christian. Let me tell you about my old man. He was an elder. Or let me tell you about my family. My dad was a pastor. Let me tell you how the church treated him. I hear so many horror stories. And having been a Christian for many years now and having been in ministry, I know they're true. I run into them all the time. I've said for a long time that American Christianity is the manure of the New Age movement. It has made it grow. It has made it spread. And without fail, when I'm talking to somebody, they'll come up almost immediately and I say, well, tell me about the church you left. Or tell me about your family. Tell me why it is you are so angry against the God of the Bible. And again, sometimes it's for causes. Well, the Bible's against homosexuality or the Bible's against astrology or whatever. But more often than that, it's how they were treated by some person or group of people. It's the lack of love. It's the lack of often truth that you see. I'll give you some examples of this. One time I was talking to this very articulate witch. She had been raised old school Amish. I'm talking Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I'm talking where the real deep theological issues are. Do you have air in your tires or not? The liberals had air in their tires, whereas we good conservatives would not allow such a thing. That's how old school Amish she was. And I said, well, what did it mean to you to be a Christian? She goes, for me to be a Christian meant that I had to have my hair parted directly down the middle when I was a teenage girl. But just to show them, I'd parted a quarter inch to the side. I said, no wonder you left. What does this have to do with Christianity? Not a darn thing. But for many people, it's that type of story they tell. Extreme legalism or anger that comes out of different things. Well, my point is that that's been going on. The New Age, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, has been evangelizing, as it were, the Christian church for many decades. But I want to argue and hopefully help you understand. There are many people in this room tonight that would see what I do and say, boy, Bill, I'm so thankful that you're doing that, that you're going to the psychic places, fairs and all these wonderful places. And sometimes we'll even support people like that, but don't ask me. I'm not into that sort of thing. That's a little heavy duty. That's too strange. And I'm here to argue tonight that my mission is, in fact, I call it normative Christian mission. It is the rare event in world history for Christians not to be part of a pagan culture that despises the minority of believers. We in America are very blessed in that respect, although that may be changing right underneath us. But for the entire history of the Christian church, it is the normal experience for people to be part of a hated minority. That was certainly how the church was born. It's how most of the churches lived in Asia or in Africa or in many other places in this world. It's we here in America who think it's weird. But if you grew up in India, it would be a normative experience for you as a Christian to basically feel the heat from people around you who despise what you believe, who think that everything you say is an offense. I gave a message here 7 years ago, Pastor Dan remembered it, called The Most Hated Words in the Bible. And part of that was based on, well, the whole thing's basically based on John 14:6, where Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. And my point in that message is to say that that's the one thing that they hate the most. And it really fits in with part of what I'm talking about tonight. You see on your outline there's syncretism. Syncretism is a big fancy word, but it's really simple. It just means mixing and matching together. It's what I just described to you as spirituality, a little bit of Native American religion, a little bit of Hinduism. I'll do some Buddhist chants. I might have a dream catcher, you know, around the house or in the car. Oh, I go to church once in a while because I want to, you know, cover all my bases. There's this great scene from the Mummy movie that came out several years ago where there's this one Weasley character named Benny. And this mummy's going around sucking the vital life out of all these characters. And the mummy catches Benny. Many of you have seen this movie, you know what I'm talking about. And just as the mummy is about to suck out the life of Benny, Benny has all these chains around his neck. And he starts going through them. One's a Buddhist one, and one's a Confucian one. And he's running through all the different religions and giving all these prayers, hoping this would hold the mummy off. And finally he holds up a Star of David and recites something in Hebrew. And the mummy lets him go. And I thought, what a great American Benny is. He's such a pragmatist. Religion is something that works for me. And I'll do whatever it takes to find something that works for me. So it's so often you'll hear some people in our wonderful little postmodern culture say, well, I'm so glad you found something that works for you. Just don't tell me I have to do it. And that's very much based on what I was just saying. It's a true offense to say there's only one way. It was just as offensive 2,000 years ago as it is today. And in the Roman world where you had gazillions of religions offered, you had the mystery religions, and I'm going to talk about them a little bit later. You had the big ones like Buddhism, you had Judaism, you had the religions of the, for example, like Zoroastrianism, you had Mithras, which also came out of Iran. You had all sorts of different religions available in the Roman world. The Greco, you know, most of you grew up understanding who the Greek gods were, the Roman version of that. You had the pagan deities of what's now France and Germany. All these were options in the Roman world. And yet only one religion stood out and was persecuted unto death numerous times throughout the first 300 years of the Christian church. Only one was nailed that way. And it had virtually nothing to do with what Christians believed about who Jesus was. You want to believe Jesus is God? Fine, we got no problem with that. Everybody's a God around here. But if you say Jesus is the only way, now we got problems. And Christianity was despised. And I would argue it's just as despised for the exact same reason right now. For you to stand in front of your neighbors and say, you know, I think Jesus is the only way. That's the quickest way I can think of to get yourself shunned at work or by your own family. And some of you know this because you've tried to talk to people and found out how quickly you are despised on that one point alone. This is syncretism. It's the idea that everybody comes to truth in their own way. They mix and match it all together. It's their own thing. It works for them, quote unquote. That's the great old pagan tool. And it's very effective. The Romans were great managers. The Greeks cared about philosophy. The Jews cared about religious, you know, rules and stuff. The Romans' gift to religion was basically this. We don't care what kind of pagan you are. Just add the emperor to your menagerie of gods, and we'll be happy with you. And for the average pagan, this was simple. Hey, I got 400 gods on the shelf already. What's another one? That's why they got along in a limited way with virtually every culture they conquered. They did not try to force their Roman gods. And why? Because they recognized that literally the Roman gods just were the different names for the same gods they saw everywhere else. In every ancient culture, you have a god of war, a god of truth, a god of beauty, a god of frogs, so on and so on. In India today, you have 330 million different gods and counting. They've taken this to a science. My professor in Hinduism held up a slide one time of a blanch white statue, as white as could be, except it had red splotches all over it. And she had seen this in a temple in India. And she asked us, anybody know what this was? And none of us had a clue. She said, it's a smallpox goddess. They're literally worshiping the virus. And that within the Hindu understanding of things, which is basically what I'm calling paganism, that the divine is in all things, that there's godly spirit, whatever you want to call it, that makes perfect sense. Not just in India, but in all sorts of other pagan cultures. And we've had this reintroduced in all sorts of ways. If you got into the Da Vinci Code and that whole thing, Gnosticism is the exact same idea. That the divine is in all things and in all people. It's one of the oldest enemies of the Christian church, is the Gnostic teachings, and now it's being reintroduced and all sorts of things. And National Geographic and NBC go so breathless this last spring. Oh, the Gospel of Judas! Yeah, old news, old Gnostic texts. been around for a long time, shares nothing new, but oh, this could be the antidote to Christianity. It's curious, in a culture that claims, and this is an old Hindu illustration, but it's very popular here in America now, in a culture that claims that all religions are like different paths up the same mountain, and that all religions are like spokes which all lead to the same hub, and all religions are like blind men circling around an elephant, each touching a different part of the elephant, thinking that they're, you know, have a unique understanding. Without understanding reality, it's all the same thing. It's interesting that there's one part of the elephant that doesn't fit, that there's one spoke which doesn't make it to the hub, and that there's one path which doesn't make it up the mountain, and that is Christianity. It is truly despised by all these wonderful, loving, tolerant people. I have been screamed at and cussed at and sometimes spit at by the most loving, tolerant, accepting people you'll ever meet. Just ask them. And they will tell you how loving and intolerant they are and how despised I am for saying what I say. So syncretism goes in the face of Christianity, and Christianity goes in the face of syncretism. There's no mixing and matching there. But as I started off with the outline there, God has been in the business of reaching these people for a long time. This is why we do what we do, even though we're not necessarily loved when we show up in these places. If you think about the Bible for just a second, what was Abraham? Nice little Jewish boy? No. From Ur, Chaldea, Babylon, pagan as can be, and yet God calls him out. Think about Ruth. What was Ruth? Nice. You see this in VBS. Sometimes here's Ruth. She's this nice little demure Jewish girl type stuff. No, she was a Moabitess. They slaughtered their children to get a good corn crop. Not exactly a nice little Jewish girl. Or how about that other nice little Jewish girl, Rahab? Sacred prostitute. They also did their rituals to get a good corn crop to ensure that nature would work. That's part of what paganism is all about, the belief that your actions interact with nature. It's why you killed your children. It's why you had sex with the temple prostitutes. Whatever it was, is to get a good corn crop, to keep the sun coming back the next day, to make sure the river doesn't overflow, on and on and on. That's the old pagan mindset. And God has been reaching these people. Think of the New Testament, because you ought to be able to relate to them. What were the people in Ephesus before they came to Christ? Or Corinth? Or Rome? Or Thessalonica? Or a whole bunch of or a whole bunch of other places. They were pagans. They worshiped nature. They had sex with the temple prostitutes. They slaughtered their kids. They did what pagans have always done. And yet God built his church out of those people. And so when I look in the psychic fair, I don't lose hope and say, oh, it's no point in this. It's because God has been grabbing these people and bringing them into his kingdom for a long, long time. And so that's one thing I want us to keep in mind, is that we don't despair because of how occultic or our friend's gotten into witchcraft or Satanism or whatever. We don't despair because our Father is bigger than whatever they're into. Trust me on that. So what I want to do is suggest there has been an attempt to reach our pagan culture over the last 20 years. And I'm going to argue tonight that it's not a good attempt, that it's very misguided, and then hopefully give us some guidelines for what I think is a biblically based attempt. And more than attempt, but a biblically based and time-honored practice of how to reach pagans and how to react to them. I want you to turn back to Isaiah chapter 10 with me. One of the things that's happened in the last 20 years, the overall nickname for it is called the church growth movement. And the idea has been, hey, look, sociologists like Peter Berger or business gurus like Peter Drucker, these guys have got wisdom and insight into who human beings are. And they've built massive corporations based on this insight. And so what we need to do is invite these fellows in, tell them, have them tell us how to build the church, how to make the church operate like a business. And there are different versions of it, from the Willow Creek model to the Saddleback model and all sorts of other points in between. And the idea has been is that what we need to do is reach the seeker. And there are certain things we're going to do to reach the seeker. And one of the first things that we're going to do is we're going to build a plant, what I lovingly call six fags over Jesus, or mall over Jesus, or whichever way you want to look at it. We are going to put our money into facilities that will attract the pagan mind, will attract the seeker. And so we have spent, literally, as of 15 years ago, there were $200 billion worth of church buildings standing in the world. Leadership Magazine says we average, that's a magazine for pastors, says we average about $6 billion a year in buildings in just America alone. All to honor a God who said he does not dwell in houses made of stone and wood. That's part of what we're going to get into. Look in Isaiah chapter 10. Verse 10 says this. Well, let's start at verse 8. Are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish, and Hamath like Arpad, and Samaria like Damascus? As my hands has reached to the kingdom of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? Now, the main focus of this passage is that God is not arbitrary. God is no respecter of persons. If his chosen people, Israel, is doing exactly what their pagan neighbors are doing, which is usually the case, he's going to nail both of them. He doesn't draw arbitrary lines. He's not culturally sensitive or worried about political considerations in other cultures. He's consistent. He's going to judge both if they're doing the same thing. But one of the things I want to highlight, again, it's not the central point of the passage, but there's this cute little quip in here that I can't make sense out of unless he's really insulting them. Look at verse 10 again. As my hand is reached to the kingdom of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria. Now, that has nothing to do with the text. It has nothing to do with the message, but he throws in this line basically saying Jerusalem and Samaria are half-stepping, okay? They're not even doing idolatry properly. If you want serious idolatry, go to the pagans. When my people try to do it, they're just not doing it well. Now you think about this. Why is that? Well, you can think this really makes sense. The pagan world commits itself to idolatry. If you look at the ancient seven wonders of the world, things like the Colossus of Rhodes and so many other things like that, they're literally religion in stone. The pagans knew how to build. They built like nobody could compete with what the pagans were up to. They built incredible structures. And again, all you have to do is take a tour of the world and see some of the things that the pagans have built in all sorts of different places. And they're amazing things. All right? Now put yourself in Jerusalem. Jerusalem never did abandon the temple. They were synchristic in this. When Jerusalem went pagan, what happens is they kept the temple, but instead of keeping it like they're supposed to, they just brought the Asherah pole and all the different idols, and they put it in the Holy of Holies. See, we don't want to be closed-minded about this. We want to be open-minded to all the traditions and accept them all. You know, that's good American thought as well. So this is what Jerusalem's doing. So you have to put at least some of your money still into keeping the temple and some of your money into idolatry. So they never could commit themselves fully into full-blown idolatry. They never got all their money. And so the prophet kind of insults them. All right, you're not even good at idolatry. You don't even do it well. So it's an interesting thing. The ancient Jews were condemned for doing what no New Testament Christian would do, and the thing that every good American Christian is committed to. How are we going to reach the lost? Well, by golly, we need a good plant. We need a serious place that will bring the pagans in, a base of operations. And we're going to make it a place. In fact, it's going to be so wonderful. We will have stores and bowling alleys and theaters, and we'll put on Christian shows. And man, if you're really good about this, you never have to get your hands dirty out there with one of those non-Christians. You never even have to speak with one. If you play it well, we'll have a retirement center right next door. So you can go from womb to the tomb and never get your hands dirty around a non-Christian. Now there's an ideal for you. We outbuild them. It's interesting to note that there is not one single church building in church history until the year 250 AD. 220, roughly 220 years after the death of Christ, before the first church building shows up. And it's up for a few months before one of the really bad persecutions, I think it was Diocletian, stomped it out. And we don't hear of another one until after 311, until Constantine made Christianity legal. Not one single artifact or building that you can, not an artifact, excuse me, building that you can point to and say, that was why the early church was doing it. Look, we see these buildings everywhere. You can see them now, but the early church didn't do it. They did not try to compete with the pagan world for building. One, I think they couldn't begin to do it because the pagans were so committed to it. But secondly, they didn't show any interest. Now, I want you to turn back two chapters in Isaiah and see another thing happen with ancient Israel. Chapter 8, verse 19. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. And if they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no light of dawn. Now here's an interesting thing. I was a youth pastor before I became a missionary, and I was a youth pastor at just the right time for this phenomena. But the idea was is that our culture was centered around music and entertainment. Therefore, to be a successful youth pastor, you had to figure out ways to inculcate that into the whole process. And I was fully on board with that whole mindset. Boy, be careful if you're having a Bible study, because the kids down the street, well, they're going to go somewhere else. If there's something, if there's party going on in a church, they're going to go to the party before they come to the Bible study. And this was a huge issue amongst youth pastors, and there was a lot of writing going back and a lot of meetings held about this sort of thing. And right at the time I was leaving youth ministry, when I got called to be a missionary, all of a sudden, there were ski trips and all these fun things, but also mission trips started to become popular. And thankfully, they've taken off, and I'm thankful for that in many ways, but the idea of actually serving instead of being entertained was being reintroduced. But the other thing I saw about youth ministry is that the youth pastors that were being hired and the ones that were becoming popular were, in fact, great comedians. Now, I have no problem with great comedians, but there's something wrong with the mindset of the church if your youth pastor doesn't cut it because he's not Jay Leno or somebody much funnier. The fact is that there are a lot of wonderful people who are geared and who love kids, but they're not near as funny as the guy down the street, and nobody was interested in going to them. And so all of a sudden you see this culling, as it were, of ministers, where only the funny were allowed to achieve. And you went to a lot of big churches, and that was one of the things that drove them, was they had a really great, funny youth pastor. Nothing wrong with being funny, but that's not a qualification for youth ministry. And that's one of the things that was happening. So the church was turning towards entertainment. I would say and that was 20 years ago when I started talking about this. Now it's full-blown. We're not even bothering in some cases. Many churches you go to, and it's all about movies and dance routines and all sorts of things. And again, none of these individually are bad things in themselves, but they've replaced the Word of God. The church is not a place to come learn and study and be edified. The church is a place to bring your pagan friends to be entertained. And if somehow our entertainment is better or at least equal to the pagan entertainment, we've achieved ourselves. We have a new definition of evangelism now, because we've equally or successfully entertained our friends. The early church did not try to compete. And here you have this interesting thing here. You have the prophet recording the words of the Lord. When people go to mediums, now, guys, this is what I do all the time, except I don't go to hear their wisdom. If I go to a psychic fair, if it's in a building like this, usually it's much bigger. But everyone I've ever been to has rings around it full of people who will read your head. They'll read the lines on your hand. They'll read your aura, your supposed energy field. They'll read your tarot cards. They'll read pickup sticks, I Ching. They will read anything to get a buck out of you. And there's huge lines waiting to have something read. Maybe some of you have gone to these things and have... If I'm insulting you, sorry, but this is the reality. I will tell you why this drives people. I'll tell you why it's so popular. All you have to do is sit and listen for a few minutes and you get a clue. And I've been doing it so long, I hear the same thing. This is cheap therapy. $15 for 15 minutes is very cheap therapy. Because nobody goes to a psychic to hear what they do not want to hear. Nobody goes to a psychic to find out that their husband's about to leave them, they're going to get fired, and their kid's going to get killed in an accident next week. That never ever happens. I will tell you what does happen. You'll meet a new man. Your job's about to turn around, or you're going to get a new job. Your kids are going to come back and be in a good position with you. Everything's going to be okay. And people line up to hear that. They want to hear that everything's going to be okay. They want to hear that it's all good. Mediums aren't in the business of giving you bad news. They can't afford to be. Won't make them any money. Which is why the prophets stand out by contrast. And all you have to do is read the Old Testament, read the stories, and read how most of these guys were treated by their countrymen who loved them so much that they usually slaughtered them every chance they got, because they were in the business of bringing God's truth, and that wasn't going to sell well. People didn't want to hear about the fact that there was something wrong with them. And it doesn't go over well today. Look at Joel Osteen, number one pastor in the country, 35,000 people a week, who makes a point of saying, you are never going to hear anything in this church that will ever disturb you or upset you. If I knew nothing else about him, that would be enough to tell me what's going on there. Of course he's growing. People want to hear what they want to hear. It doesn't mean that they're going to hear what they need to hear. But they do want to hear what they want to hear. That's always sold well. Well, here you have this phenomena where people are going to the mediums, the people who whisper and mutter, the people who are talking to spirits. Again, I have so many variations of this I run into all the time. And they're paying good money to hear this wonderful news. Now, by contrast, the apostle says, or the prophet in this case, says, should not a people consult their God? Should not a people, instead of listening to the dead, consult the living God? Now, this is one of the interesting things. Why do I go to a non-Christian to teach me how to run a church? Why do I go to a non-Christian to teach me how to set up ministry? Why do I go to non-Christians to teach me how to think and operate well in this culture? But that's exactly where the church has gone. We've gone to the experts, and they've turned our churches into corporations. And instead of having a pastor, you have a CEO. And the CEO is very hard to get a hold of. Might not ever actually get his hands dirty with sheep, because there's a whole other level of executives that will get there long before he ever has to deal with it. I'm going to go into that in more detail in just a minute, but here he's saying these fascinating things. To the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn. I think the first person that went to Peter Drucker and found out, you know, and it wasn't just Drucker, there's so many others that did this, that the best way to raise churches is, and this is one of the major principles of church growth thinking, is homogenous church units. In other words, people like to be with their own kind. White people like to be with white people. Black people like to be with black people. Asians like to be with Asians. I was born in Beaumont, Texas originally, one of the most racist cities on this planet. What used to be sin is now strategy. Something's very wrong here. And we have it all over the church. That's just one example of many. That should have been enough for the powers that be in the Christian church to say, you know, we've already heard more. Thank you. We don't need this anymore. But no, we had to go for more. There's so much more to doing this. What did the early church do about this? Do we go to the pagans? Did the early church go down to the Corinthian temples and say, you know, you guys have got a great business going here. Thousands of travelers come to Corinth for the privilege of having sex with the temple prostitutes. Man, it's amazing. In the temple, there's nothing like it in the whole world. Oh, we've got some things to... You guys have some wisdom. Could you please share that with us so we can set up our Corinthian church? In fact, you could argue the Corinthian church was, in fact, doing that already when the apostle had to come in and kick some serious rear end in 1 Corinthians because they were so much like their culture. Now, we have a new version of this, by the way, since I first did this message. And our latest newsletter talked about this, what's called the emerging church movement. There's a zillion variations of this. I'm basically finished with my doctoral studies at the University of Denver. Virtually everybody in my department is hardcore postmodern. And my dissertation's on Friedrich Nietzsche, who's considered the grandfather of postmodern thought. And I'm not going to go into all the details of it tonight, but it's amazing to me that Nietzsche's grandchildren, Derrida, Foucault, Richard Rorty, all these guys, that all of a sudden these guys have become great resources for Christian churches. And if you read a Brian McLaren or other emerging church leaders, you'll see them talking this way. That these guys have insight and wisdom that we need. I'm thinking, oh no, have you actually read these people? Do you know what they really say? How corrosive postmodern thought really is. How you can argue that there's no such thing as truth and still call yourself a Christian is an amazing, amazing statement to me. Considering there are literally hundreds of references in the Gospels alone. Well, do you remember Jesus saying, I am the way, I am one of many opinions, and I am the life? Or, perhaps, I say to you. No, I'm sorry, I could get lost on the postmodern thing all night long. I have a whole different seminar on that. But it's the same principle. We're going to non-Christians and saying, teach us your wisdom. Give us your insight. Whether it's Freud or the occultist Maslow or the occultist Carl Gustav Jung, there are so many variations of this where we're going to the world, to the dead, and saying, teach us how to live. There's something terribly wrong here. By contrast, the prophet says, no, we should consult God. To the law and to the testimony, to God's word is where God's people need to go. Not to the thoughts of the dead. Well, as we've turned our churches into corporations, this is what we've gained. The pastor is now the CEO. He's not a shepherd. What does that look like? Well, we need a new solution for sin, for example. We can't talk about sin anymore than hell or, you know, all that nasty stuff that gets people upset. This is Joel Osteen on drugs here. Sin is now a therapeutic problem. And instead of church discipline, we must, in fact, set you up at a counseling session, where you will get years of therapy. And you can see with, say, like somebody like Woody Allen, how well this has worked. 30 years of therapy, you end up running off and raping your adopted daughter and then marrying her. Oh, the culture loves this. We need a new understanding of evangelism. It doesn't involve confronting a sinner with their sin. It doesn't involve talking about the fact that their behaviors will destroy them. No. Again, we need to make it comfortable for them to come into church so they'll never, ever hear anything that might threaten them. We need a new understanding of discipline. Forget it. Absolutely forget it. There was an example, some of your older ones remember the Donahue Show, and about 25 years ago, there was one episode of the Donahue Show where they had this woman on from Oklahoma, and she was married, she was involved in an adulterous affair with somebody. Her church disciplined her. Shock of shocks. And then she went down the street, again, the American cure for discipline is just to go down the street, go to another church. She went down the street to the other church, and the pastoral staff of her first church had the terrible, terrible sensibilities about this to notify the new church that she, in fact, was living in sin, that she was destroying her marriage. And that got them sued. So by the time it hit the Donahue Show, it was about to go to the circuit court. There had been a lot of appeals at this point. And Donahue gets up and he says, "Well, what right does a church have to tell anybody how they should live?" And, of course, the crowd was cheering. I'm crying watching this because it just told you all you needed to know about where so many people were at. Church has no business telling anybody what's right and wrong. Okay. Forget discipline. And we need a new understanding of discernment. None. Absolutely none allowed. Before you stands one of the most hateful, divisive persons you'll ever meet. Just ask people. Why? Well, because sometimes I say it's wrong to do certain things, and sometimes I say it's right to do other things. I don't think that makes me an unusual person. I seem to see that all over the Bible. But in the New Age world, I'm just a terrible person. And with many people who call themselves Christian, there's something terribly wrong with me. I was told by people one time, by Christians, that I should not use the R word. Repent. Maybe you should excise that off the CD. Because people get offended by it. Of course they do. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if you've ever tried to share your faith and talk about the reality of sin in your parents' life, you know the fact that they're cheating on each other and getting drunk and beating each other up, that may not be the best way to live, that it may, in fact, not only be wrong with each other, but it may put them in the wrong place with God. And, of course, as you've explained this kind of thing, they've been so appreciative of you sharing that with them. They've been so happy. "I am so glad you're here to tell me what a screw-up I am." No, it never works that way. And I can guarantee you the first people that told me about it got an earful from me and got cussed out. Nobody wants to be told that there's something wrong with them. This is why the New Age sells so well. This is why the New Age spirituality is so popular. Everything you could ever want, you're wonderful. You're the center of the universe. You're the divine spark of all things. And then there's those Christians. "Oh, you're a mess." Well, it's hard to be a New Ager and look at the newspapers and read the internet or just live life with the belief that everybody's okay and everybody's God and everybody's all right and everybody's one and there's no such thing as good and evil and all this other New Age stuff. It's very hard to actually deal with the real world and have those beliefs, yet millions have tried and continue to try. So anyways, I've been rattling on about all the bad stuff. Is there good things? Are there some breakthroughs here? And what I want to argue today is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel in order to reach our pagan friends. Because I'm going to try to argue, as much as I would say that we're so similar to the Roman world as far as zillions of religious options, the early church was not only surviving in the Roman world, they were thriving. I have a slide that I show sometimes with this seminar out of a Zondervan's history book on church history, and it has the churches around the Mediterranean area. If you just visualize for a second, there's just a handful of churches surrounding the Mediterranean at the end of the first century. By the end of the second century, it's quite a thick belt. By the end of the third century, it's just huge, and the churches have gone all the way towards Russia and way down in Africa and everywhere else. This is all during a time when they haven't got a single church building, they're not out entertaining the pagans, and they're being persecuted and hated. And yet, like a cancer, the Christian church is eating the Roman Empire inside out. Now, how did that happen? That's what I want to focus on. By the way, if you think I've been harsh on the church growth of the emerging church people, and you really are, you know, think pragmatically, and we ought to, let me just ask you this. 1980, Time Magazine declared 1980 the year of the evangelical. Well, those of you who have been around a little while, would any of you like to argue that America is discernibly more Christian today than it was 26 years ago? Hard to sell, isn't it? Even if I believed in this stuff, It doesn't work. It's not working. If you want to see what church buildings do for culture in the long sense, go to Europe. Some of the most incredible architecture in the world is right there. Churches all over Europe. They make wonderful museums, fine tombs, great mausoleums, and they're all completely empty. Why? Less than 2% of Europe's population goes to a church of any kind. Why? Well, there's a whole lot more to that story that I can give you tonight, but all I can argue, if church buildings are the solution, then something went wrong over there. And the more you start thinking about where those buildings came from and how they were built and on whose back St. Peter's Basilica and so many of those things were built, then you start to get one sensibility of what's wrong there. We'll go into that in just a minute. I want to argue that the early church had a model that was both biblically based and pragmatic. I don't mean pragmatist in that they were just looking for what worked. I mean it was pragmatic in that it did work because it was biblical, because God is sovereign and God knows what is best. And God is wise enough and thorough enough to tell us what we need to do to evangelize our world. I'm going to take Ephesians 4:15 as a model. You don't need to look it up, but it says, speaking the truth in love one to another. And the point of Haven Ministries, our whole attitude about this, is if it's good enough to speak the truth in love to our Christian brothers and sisters, then it's also good enough that we do this to our non-Christian friends of whatever stripe. Virtually every religion, I didn't mention this on Islam this morning, but Islam has a principle called taqiyya, which basically means it's okay to lie. Virtually every religion, the Buddhists have upaya, skillful means, it's okay to lie. My favorite version of this is the Moonies, the Unification Church, they call it heavenly deception. Whatever the Mormons have a version, Jehovah's, everybody's got a version of how it's okay to lie to each other. And every once in a while I hear Christians playing that game. Well, you know, it's okay, a little hyperbole, a little evangelistic license, you know, to bring them in. No, we can't be in that business. We have to speak the truth in love to our neighbors. So the first part of this, I want to break it down, is the truth. The early church was not afraid to speak the truth in their culture. They spoke out against war, especially the Roman wars, which are basically just conquests. They spoke out about how the Romans treated the poor. They spoke out about slavery. They spoke out about abortion. They spoke out about so many different things. And the number one target of the Roman world, you got a glimpse of in that movie a few years ago, Gladiator. Although it doesn't begin to give you the horror of the hundreds of thousands of people that were killed all over the Roman Empire every single year in the games, in the Colosseums. You know, one of the earliest nicknames, derogatory nicknames, that the non-Christian, the Romans had for Christians was? They called us people haters. Why were we people haters? Well, it's pretty simple, y'all. We wouldn't go to the Colosseum to watch people getting slaughtered. So we're people haters. That's kind of a fun twist on the whole thing, isn't it? The emperor made it real plain. How do you keep the empire running? Well, bread and circuses. Keep them fed, keep them entertained. That will keep them mollified. They won't revolt. That was the old Roman way. And so the games were set up virtually everywhere in the Roman Empire. And this one basically grabbed the Christians so much that the early Christian community said, if you get baptized and then you go back to the games, you're excommunicated. You will not be able to take communion with the church. They took it that seriously. That's how despised it was. And the first thing Constantine did when he took over as emperor was he didn't make Christianity a state religion. His sons did that. But he did make it legal, and then he stopped the games. Because that was such a critical issue for the early Christians. We are not going to go watch people get slaughtered. They didn't see the benefit of today's video games. Man, we can do, at least in our minds, twice as much damage as the old Romans. They were pikers. Well, anyways, the early Christian church spoke out again. All you have to do is go on the internet tonight or go to a library and look for the Antonicene Fathers. And what you will find is literally thousands of pages of documents, letters, sermons, books, all sorts of things written by church leaders, sometimes by lay people, written to the emperor, written to the governors, written to military leaders all over the empire, challenging them on how they were treating people. The early Christian church was not afraid to speak out against injustice. And most of all, and this is what drove the Romans so crazy, the early church spread the gospel. The early church would not agree that Caesar is Lord. No, Jesus alone is Lord. He's it. He's the center of everything. And we're not going to mix and match him with the Gnostic gods and the Greek gods and all the rest. Jesus is it. And that, for that offense, they were despised all over the empire. But they weren't afraid. And these people were getting killed. I am at the point right now where it's hard for me to read American church leaders. Because one of the big things happening in the church right now, not in the pagan world, but in the church, is people saying this: hey, look, people look at me funny when I say that Jesus is the only way, and that really disturbs me, and that seems unfair, but I don't want to be liberal and say that all religions are the same, so I'm going to kind of come to a new point. It's called inclusivism. And this is the belief that people are saved by Jesus whether they like it or not. You don't actually have to believe in Jesus. And the Catholics got the ball rolling on this in Vatican II, and they came up with the phrase anonymous Christian. So Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims are already Christians. They just don't know it yet. Yay! Well, by the way, if you talk to any Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims on this point, it's quite offensive to them, and I think it should be for what they're saying. But this wasn't content to stay in the Catholic Church, and this is now rolled into Protestant churches. And some of my former heroes, like Clark Pinnock and John Stott and now J.I. Packer, I just read this one a couple months ago, really frustrated me. Christian writers who I've always respected have come out and said, you don't have to believe in Jesus to be saved. You know what? 68% of the self-identified American church agrees with them. And now Rick Warren's come out on his website and said, you don't have to believe in Jesus to be saved. One of my board members is I'm not a big fan of Rick Warren. I've already told you what I think of the church growth movement. But one of my board members is a big fan. And, I pray for his salvation, things like this. But I sent him this stuff from the website. And he says, this is not what he was saying 8 years ago. And I said, I know. I'm critical of his methods, but I never, challenged his theology at this point. But here he is now claiming you don't have to believe in Jesus. This is the accommodation that American pastors are making. Is there any threat on our lives if we don't? No. But if you read K.P. O'Hannon's books, or you read Vishal Mangalwadi, or Ravi Zacharias, or Ajith Fernando, or Asian pastors and leaders, who are in fact are in cultures where their lives are threatened for this belief, they're not taking a step backwards. No, it's about the gospel. The gospel is necessary. Jesus is the only way. Whereas American church leaders are rolling over backwards to pretend that it's all one big happy spiritual family. We have forgotten the truth. We're busy hiding it. If you read Brian McLaren, if you're a fan of the emerging church, in his newest book that just came out this spring, The Secret Teachings of Jesus, he says, and this is almost word for word, the kingdom of God is made up already of Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims, and the Christians just need to catch up with that whole thought. Wow, I have been wasting my time all these years. And those Southern Baptists who were killed in Pakistan a couple years ago, they were wasting their time. And the Gospel for Asia people, they are wasting their time. Why risk your life? Why not build yourself gigantic Six Flags over Jesus? Everybody's already saved. Let's just party on. The early church didn't have that mentality. The early church spoke the truth. Even though it cost many of them their lives, they were not worried about being bad dinner company. They were not worried about being sent to an enlightenment class in their Fortune 500 company where they can learn how everybody's okay no matter what they think or believe, except for you Christians, of course. The second thing they did was they acted out of love. So this is why I said the combination of truth and love. One of my favorite apologists, one of the first guys that my youth pastor turned me on to, was a guy named Francis Schaeffer. I grew up believing Christians are all idiots. And I didn't know any, but I was positive they had to be idiots. And then I became one. So I was like, now I are an idiot. I guess I have to, give up half of my brain to come to church or something. And one of the things my youth pastor did a favor to me, I love to read. I read everything he gave me. And he gave me this guy, Francis Schaeffer. I don't know who Schaeffer is. But I find myself, by the second paragraph, having to reread it, which I almost never had to do. And I'm like, whoa, this guy is deep. And it was Schaeffer that first turned me on to what the Bible had already said, that we are called to love God with our heart, soul, and our minds, that we are called to take every thought captive, that Paul reasons with the Jews in the synagogue and reasoned in the streets in Athens, that our mind, in fact, is a gift from God and should be used from God. And it was Schaeffer that first turned me on to that whole idea. And then I started studying Asian religion later on and started getting into Hinduism, Buddhism. Then I run into, guess what? Your mind is the enemy of enlightenment. Turn your mind off. Your mind is bad. Your mind is evil. It's terrible. It will ruin you. Boy, by the time you get into Zen and all this kind of stuff, your mind is the worst possible thing you can ever get into. And that's all over the New Age as well. And then all of a sudden I start hearing pastors talk that way and prophets, so-called prophets on TV, and oh, we are in trouble. And I heard Rodney, just for one of many examples, I heard Rodney Howard Brown, the supposing laughing prophet, several years ago, and Rodney said up here, oh, God has a special place for you, but you can't go there with your mind. Oh, no, your mind will take you to the wrong place. You've got to shut your mind off. And now we have the contemplative prayer movement doing the exact same thing. Folks, I've said this for a long time. I'll say it to you guys. Anybody who tells you to turn your mind off, be it your parents, the Pope, Billy Graham, me, or anybody else, there ought to be a flag coming up warning garbage coming in. Because the only reason you do that is because somebody's about to tell you 2 plus 2 equals 5. And if your mind left to its own would say, that's stupid. And if I stood up in front of you and said 2 plus 2 equals 5, you'd say, get this moron out of here. And rightly so. But if somehow I put on real religious-looking robes, you know, like Dan wears, you guys have seen it. I put on these really religious-looking clothes, and I come up here and I spread some sage around and I chant Om or something, and I look at you and say, 2 plus 2 equals 5. Oh, that's a higher, deeper, more profound truth. No, it's a lie. It's always a lie. And that's why they're trying to tell you to shut your mind down, because what I'm about to tell you is so stupid and illogical, you'll never buy it. And this is one of the key issues. We've bought into the culture in such a sense, our culture has become so irrational. Guys, I will tell you, the stupidest meeting I've been to I've literally been to hundreds of New Age meetings. The stupidest meeting I've been to was not led by Shirley MacLaine or somebody like that, although I've been to a lot of those meetings. The stupidest meeting I've ever been to was led by professors from MIT, Massachusetts Institute for Technology. Let me illustrate this. This is 13 years ago at the Parliament of World Religions. 5,000 people there, academics, world leaders, Cardinal Bernadette, just unbelievable crowd. And we're sitting in this huge room. I'm with a Jews for Jesus friend of mine who'd never been to a New Age meeting before. I said, you're going to love this. Come on in. We're sitting down, and a lady up in front who's teaching, she says, I want everybody to put all their stuff down on the floor. And I go, oh, good, group grope. You have to understand, when you've turned your brain off, you've got to do something with your time. All right, so it gets really silly. So the lady says, what I want you to do is I want each person here, remember, this is our engineers talking this way, okay? She says, I want each person here to share your noise. And for the next 2 solid minutes, 5,000 people are going, ah! And I'm now elbowing, I had been a youth pastor, I'm like, if I could bring my junior high kids here, I'd give them some noises they could share, all right? And this goes on for 2 minutes, a lady rings the bell, and the whole crowd falls apart. It's like it's the most cathartic, incredible experience they've had in their entire life. People are weeping and crying, oh my gosh, that was incredible. They're losing it all over the place. I'm trying not to, you know, blow chunks at this point. It is so bad. You can't throw up in front of people. They get offended when you try to talk to them later on, but the lady's like, wait, there's more. This time I want you to share your noise, but listen to other people's noise. Like phones. And so another 2 minutes of, the bell rings, people are losing again. Again, this was not Shirley MacLaine. This was professors from MIT. And I came back, I was actually in the graduate school at CU Boulder at the time, and I wrote a paper, a reaction paper to this whole thing to my philosophy professor, and I basically said, if this is where the culture is heading, when so many academics see this as a good thing, then it may be the Christian church, like the Middle Ages, the so-called Dark Ages, is the only place where rational thinking will go forward again, because the culture is abandoning the mind. And you see this in so many ways. Well, I argue that as Christians, we're not to abandon our mind, but rather to love God and serve Him with our minds. And part of that means speaking the truth in love to New Agers. And part of speaking the truth is addressing some of the ideas that are so horrific. Guys, if this stuff was so good, if these ideas were so wonderful and so incredibly powerful in changing people and cultures, then wouldn't you see that in places like Kathmandu and Bangkok and Calcutta, where they believe these things for thousands of years? Or does it look a little bit more like hell on earth there when you see what actually goes on? I'm not going to go into all the details of what those cultures are all about, but one of the most powerful ideas in the new spirituality, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, most variations of Buddhism, whether it's witchcraft or goddess worship, one of the most powerful ideas that is always sold as a positive is the idea that we're all one, and that's monism, and the idea that we're all God, and that's pantheism. Monistic pantheism, it's called. Isn't it wonderful? Why, we'd never go to war with Iraq, and we'd never pollute if we just understood that we're all one, and that one thing is God. I can't tell you how many variations of that I hear. You may have a different superstructure, but the foundation's always the same. We're all one, and we're all God. Let me just give you one illustration of how I talk to people who think this way. I was talking to a young Jewish girl a couple years ago at the psychic fair. She reminded me a lot of... My family went back and forth. I went back and forth between my families, I should say. But when I was in California, most of my neighbors were Jewish, non-observant. My high school was nicknamed Hebrew High. It's just a very non-observant, you know, Reformed Jewish neighborhood. And one of my friends, when I was 12, he took me over to his house, and he had He showed me his dad's wrist, and his dad had the tattoo from Auschwitz on her. His dad had been a child there. And I didn't really understand it when I was 12. I came to understand it later on. And so I'm telling Susie this whole thing about, you know, my own experience with Jewish people and my experience with my friend's dad's arm. And I said, Susie, let me ask you something. You really believe that we're all one and we're all God? She says, oh, yes. I said, Susie, was that just God killing God in Auschwitz? And she literally takes a physical step back and just starts to think this through for a second. And they got very mad and stormed off. I'm not interested in getting in conversations, but I'm very interested in having people think. Having them think about what it is they really believe. Do you really believe that we're all one and we're all God? Oh, yes. Do you really believe there are no differences and we shouldn't be judgmental? Oh, yes. And so it's all really the same thing. Yes. You've got it. You're so close. And I say, so there's really no difference there between, oh, say, Gandhi and Charlie Manson. And there's no difference between Martin Luther King Jr. and Hitler. And there's no difference then between, say, Jeff Dahmer and Mother Teresa. Love your neighbor, eat your neighbor. It's all the same. Folks, this is what they're really saying, but they've never been taught to think it through. And part of my job as a missionary is to help people think what they're saying, what the gurus have been telling them. All you have to do is pick with the national head of communications for the Hare Krishnas. Now, many of you are as old as I am. Remember in the 60s when the Hare Krishnas really start to show up and they're chasing you everywhere through the airport and stuff like this, through the malls. Here's their national director. He talked like C.S. Lewis. I understood why he was their communications guy. It's like I was talking to a Christian, except I know better. I've read the Gita. I teach out of the Bhagavad Gita, the central text for Hindus, especially Hare Krishnas and others. And we got in this whole discussion about what the Gita says and what Krishna says. Now, every Hindu I've ever asked, if I ask them, do you think it's okay to murder? Their eyes get huge. What are you saying? Of course not. I would never murder anybody. That's so wrong. I said, okay, do you believe in the Gita? Oh, I love the Gita. Oh, it's the most important book of my life. Great. Then look in the second chapter of the Gita, where the story about Arjuna the warrior is told, where Arjuna's dilemma, which is his moral dilemma, is set up, and what Arjuna is told is that it's okay to kill people. In fact, at one point, Krishna says, slay with glee. Be happy while you kill. Whistle while you work, however you want to say this. It's okay. Why? Because nobody ever dies, and nobody ever murders. There is no such thing as death. It's all an illusion. It's what the Hindus called Maya. If you never heard of the term, you saw the first Matrix movie, you got the idea. The world of perception is an illusion. And this is what all the gurus have said for thousands of years, and what they say over here as well. So all this good and evil stuff just washes out. All right? That's what the New Age is teaching. But I haven't met a single New Ager who can live that out. Most of the New Agers I know are activists. The world's an illusion, but we should get upset about, you know, oil exploration, or we should get upset about how people are treating the whales, or upset about date rape, or whatever. I'm sorry, if the world's an illusion, none of that matters, does it? One way or the other, it never happened. It's not real. We have to help our friends think through what they're being told. The liar is really good at what he says. And he doesn't have to be very complex because we're so stupid, we keep buying the same lies generation after generation. I have one book at home called The Hunger of Eve. It's by Barbara Marx Hubbard. It's her autobiography, how she was raised a Christian and became a New Ager. Now, she's not Shirley MacLaine, although she comes up in the same time period. She's not an actress. She's a very serious person. She's one of the top futurists in the world. She was the second choice for Democratic vice president candidate, as well as she's one of the joint U.S.-Soviets. When the U.S. and the Soviets were having a conference in the late 80s, she represented our government in those meetings. So this is a very serious woman. And I've heard her speak and had some interaction with her before. Barbara is giving this whole story, and what she says is interesting. The Hunger of Eve is based on the Genesis story. And in it, on the cover of the book, is an apple. Supposedly, Eve bites an apple, right? And out of the bite, you can look inside the bite, and there's the universe. So what's the point of the story? Lucifer's the good guy of the story. Jehovah is the bad guy. By the way, the Mormons have the same teaching on this. Lucifer wanted us to discover our true godhood, who we really are, open up the universe of infinite possibilities to ourselves. Whereas Jehovah tried to keep this wonderful truth from us, so he's a bad guy. And basically she points out that what the snake said is exactly what she believes. Now this is not me as a Christian throwing rocks. This is her as a committed New Ager, a leader, saying what is obvious. When it says you'll never die, guess what? Reincarnation. When it says you will be as God, guess what? Pantheism. Well, these are old lies. They just keep showing up in new places. So I believe we're called to speak the truth and respond to these things. Is it really a wonderful thing that we're all one? I have one Buddhist friend in my doctoral program named Linda. She's a Soka Gakka Buddhist, which is very big here in California, or NSA Buddhist, depending on which way you call it. Ultimately, her version of Buddhism says that there's only one. There's only one thing out there. They have different names for it, Buddha consciousness or whatever like this. Buddhists are so diverse, there's so many different groups. And Linda considers herself a person deeply concerned with ethics. And I asked Linda one time, I said, Linda, help me understand this now. You're so passionate about ethics, yet your deepest religious belief says there is no two. There's only one. How do you have ethics in a world where there's only one? Doesn't ethics require at least two? Because this is what Maya tells you, there's only one. You've been fooled into thinking there's lots, that there's many, but there's only one. And once you understand what Maya really means, there's no such thing as ethics anymore. And all the gurus have always said this. I'm trying to get Linda to think, because she's a smart person. I want her to think well. And she's bought a lie. And they told her to turn her brain off and go meditate and chant Nomo Myoho Renge Kyo hours every day until your world turns around. That's what happens when you chant mindlessly for hours and hours. Your world does turn around, usually for the worse, but that's another story. Francis Schaeffer said this. Francis Schaeffer calls this the final apologetic. At the end of the day, I can have and have had many conversations with people about why they ought to believe in the Bible, about why they ought to believe in Jesus, on and on and on. These are all important arguments. They're all a serious part of what we do. If you go on our website, you'll see we've written about quite a bit of these things, how we talk to people. But at the end of the day, the one thing that they have no possible answer for is the love of God as exhibited by Jesus Christ and lived out by you. And that's what Schaeffer called the final apologetic, and I cut that article out. It was one of the last things he wrote before he died, and it's moved me deeply ever since. How did the early church spend their time? Well, guys, look at your quote that you've got. It's on the back of your little thing, and I think Dan's going to put it up here on the screen. This is a letter from the Emperor Julian. He's considered the last pagan emperor of Rome. I want you to hear his complaint. He's writing a pagan priest named Arsacius down in Galatia, which is what we call Turkey today. Is it not working? Well, we got it on the back, so you can look it on the back there. I want you to hear how the early church was reaching out to people. So what did the early church do with their money since they weren't building buildings and entertaining people? Well, some of the things that we know they were doing is that they were buying slaves their freedom. That was a huge issue in the early church. Now, consider the difference between building a building and buying somebody out of slavery and what an impact you actually have in the world. And did you know that you can buy people out of slavery right now? It was an elementary class in Denver about 8 years ago now that basically took on a project what was happening in Sudan and how the Muslims, the religion of peace, were basically attacking and enslaving and destroying entire villages of both black Christians and black animists, pagans. And this group, this little elementary class, started to raise money to buy people out of slavery. And it got to the point, we got to the United Nations, it became such a huge issue. And here's Jesse Jackson and other poverty pimps basically out there saying, this is a terrible thing to do, we shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. Oh, really? Well, because he was basically angling for Muslim money. He was getting money from Gaddafi and all sorts of people. He didn't want anybody to insult Islam. Here's this group of elementary kids, not even a Christian group, driven by compassion for people who are caught up in slavery, like Muslims have always done. And that's the actual history of it. You can buy people out of slavery right now. That was one thing that they did. Another huge issue of what they did was that they would adopt. The ancient Christians adopted right and left. Because one of the old pagan habits was to basically abandon children, or especially babies, that you didn't like. So if they were, just for whatever reason, you had too many kids, you just take them out and leave them outside the city, and they'd die. And what would happen is the Christians would go out and grab them and bring them into their own family. Now, as Dan mentioned this morning, we have 8 children. 5 of them are adopted. Guys, I've been an apologist and whatever, as a missionary for a long time. I've been in discussions and debates with New Agers all over this country, with my own professors in the philosophy department, religious studies at the University of Denver and other places. There are certain levels of people I talk to that could care less what I say. But I will tell you this. Many of them have been deeply moved by the fact that we've adopted all these kids. And it has made a major impact in my own family as well. This is the kind of thing that the early church did. Instead of investing in bricks, instead of investing in entertainment, instead of saying we have to have this program and that program, they started investing in people. Do we have the letter up? Well, there it is. Why do we not notice that it's their kindness to strangers, their cares for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done the most to increase atheism? That's another nickname for the Romans had for Christians. I want to stop on that one line, the graves of the dead. What is he talking about here? Well, one of the phenomena of the ancient world is that it was basically slave. Half the Roman city, in fact, half of the empire, the Roman city itself, Rome, was in fact slave. It estimates up to 2 million people there were slaves from all sorts of parts of the world. The Gauls from France, the Germans, the Egyptians, Persians, Greeks, anybody the Romans had run into got enslaved. Now, they didn't like the Romans, all these different groups, but they didn't like each other either. Egypt and Babylon had several wars between them. The Greeks and the Persians had several wars between them. The Germans and the French tribes had always fought. The Celts and the Romans had fought for thousands of years at this point. Here's all these groups who hate each other. And they're all now enslaved by the one common enemy, the Romans. Now, what happens when you're a slave is that you can't buy anything. You can't buy property. That was only for free people. So if, say, your dad died, you had the privilege, in most cases, either they'd burn him outside the city, or in many cases, they would just take the bodies and they would throw them over and basically throw them on the rocks down below. And you had the privilege of walking over there to the wall each day and seeing your father be torn up by animals or chewed up by birds or whatever, which even in the pagan mindset was a horrible insult. So what happened? Well, imagine the shock. Let's say you're a Persian slave. You got conquered by the Romans. And all of a sudden, a Greek fellow comes up to you and says, I understand your father has died. Can we help you? We'd like to find a burial plot for your father. Now, here's one of your oldest enemies that predates the Roman Empire by 1,000 years. Imagine your shock that he is coming to you to help you out. What's the first thing that's going to go through your mind? Why? Why would you do this of all people? This is what the Christians were doing. They were buying grave plots for people who had died. Something so simple. This is where the deacons' funds were going, was to take care of people in some of their most hard times. This is what he says. Let's go on. I believe we ought really and truly to practice every one of these virtues. I've always thought if you had to put yourself in the position of this priest, what he heard. Don't you understand? We put on orgies that last for months. Man, we do things that no Christian would ever think of. What do you mean we're going to act like them? And it is not enough for you alone to practice them, but so just all the priests in Galatia without exception. In the second place, admonish them, no priest may enter a theater or drink in a tavern. This had to just freak him out, because the priests, of course, were party boys. Or drink in a tavern or control any craft or trade that is base and not respectable. Now, this is my favorite one. In every city, establish hostels in order that strangers may profit by our generosity. I do not mean for our people only. Now, most of you know what a hostel is. It's a place where people can stay cheaply if they're traveling. You know, they're set up all over the world in many cases. But what does he say when he says, I don't mean for our people only? Well, what's very common, and it was certainly common in the time of Rome, and it's pretty common today. Romans take care of Romans. Greeks take care of Greeks. Jews take care of Jews. Persians take care of Persians. Egyptians take care of Egyptians. Just look at our cities here. Take the immigrant cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. What do you see? Little Italy, little Korea, little Puerto Rico, fill in the blank. They take care of their own. That makes perfect sense to people. My mother, who was raised in Beaumont her whole life, and loves her white grandchildren. She very much loves them. That makes perfect sense to her. She's taking care of her own. When we brought the first two home from the Philippines, in fact, when she heard about it, she was deeply upset. These were the wrong color. They didn't fit the scheme. She would not send them birthday cards, presents, Christmas cards, anything for the first couple years. Then it's almost 5 years ago now, we came out to Los Angeles, brought the kids with us, and she had a hard time being hateful around them. Well, about 5 years ago now, I called her up and I said, Mom, I've got good news. And she says, really? Is it good? And I said, well, we think it is. And that must have been the clue for her. And she goes, this is a long pregnant pause. And she goes, just tell me you're not adopting again. I said, no, Mom, we are. We're going back to the Philippines again and getting two more kids. And she was deeply upset. But I tell you this, my father, who is not a Christian, who hates everything about Christianity, My father, who despised that I went to Bible college, despised I went to seminary, and I became a Baptist missionary, the worst of all things, did not allow me to talk once to him the first 25 years I was a Christian. Every time I tried to bring it up, I got screamed at and cussed at and walked off. He would not answer my letters. He would hang up the phone. Both him and my middle brother did this. Since 7 years ago, since the first time we adopted the kids from the Philippines, I've had long, detailed talks with both my dad and my brother that I never had before. Now, I'm not saying there's a one-for-one correspondence, but I don't think it's accidental. Again, I know with my mom, to be raised in Beaumont, again, this incredibly racist community, why are you doing this? What's the matter with you? There's something terribly wrong with you. You're right, there is. I don't think the way you do. I have a whole different category that my mom can't possibly make sense of. That's what was going on in the ancient Roman world. He says, I don't mean for our people only, finish the thought here, but for others also who are in need of money. For it is disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans, guess who, support both their own poor and ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid of us. Do you hear his complaint? What's the heart of his complaint? Those darn Christians take better care of our people than we do. And we've got to stop it. You want to know how to reach a pagan world? You love these people. You cross lines you're not supposed to cross. Let me give you real examples again. One of my friends who was a missionary in Japan for many years, was with the Conservative Baptists at the time I went to seminary with him, Phil and Sharon, as white can be. And they adopted two Japanese babies. Now, you have to understand, the Japanese don't adopt. It's just so far from Shinto thought, because of ancestor worship and a whole bunch of other complicating things, that it's just not a part of their culture at all. Secondly, Japanese see all non-Japanese, be you white or Chinese or whatever, as foreign devils, gaijin. That's what you are. So how would Phil and Sharon minister? They took their double stroller and walked up and down the business district in Tokyo, and the Japanese would freak out. Here's these two very obvious gaijin white people, and they've got these two Japanese children. They're like, it just can't make any sense. They don't even have a category to make sense out of this. And so the first thought in their mind is, why are you doing this? We don't even do this. That's a great question to hear from a non-Christian. When is the last time somebody looked at you and said, why are you doing this? It's so bizarre. And guess what? They don't say it because of our buildings. And they don't say it because of entertainment. They say it because we love people we're not supposed to love. Have you thought about people here you're not supposed to love? Is it the prostitute on the other side of state line? Is it maybe the Mexican community that's serving in the restaurants and the hotels? Are there other lines that you're not supposed to cross that good, stable people of the right mindset as a good American is, a good middle-class people who think the right way, we're not supposed to talk to these people, we're not supposed to interact with them? After all, they're dirty and they're not like me. No, they're not. But God loves them as much as he loves me or anybody else in this room. This is what the early church was willing to do. The early church brought together Romans and Greeks and Jews and Persians and Egyptians and Gauls and all these other people and made them into one body. Oh, there were struggles for sure. You can read it all over the New Testament. It's disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans, guess who, support both their own poor and ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid of us. Do you hear his complaint? What's the heart of his complaint? Those darn Christians take better care of our people than we do. And we've got to stop it. You want to know how to reach a pagan world? You love these people. You cross lines you're not supposed to cross. Let me give you real examples again. One of my friends who was a missionary in Japan for many years, was with the Conservative Baptists at the time I went to seminary with him, Phil and Sharon, as white can be. And they adopted two Japanese babies. Now, you have to understand, the Japanese don't adopt. It's just so far from Shinto thought, because of ancestor worship and a whole bunch of other complicating things, that it's just not a part of their culture at all. Secondly, Japanese see all non-Japanese, be you white or Chinese or whatever, as foreign devils, gaijin. That's what you are. So how would Phil and Sharon minister? They took their double stroller and walked up and down the business district in Tokyo, and the Japanese would freak out. Here's these two very obvious gaijin white people, and they've got these two Japanese children. They're like, it just can't make any sense. They don't even have a category to make sense out of this. And so the first thought in their mind is, why are you doing this? We don't even do this. That's a great question to hear from a non-Christian. When is the last time somebody looked at you and said, why are you doing this? It's so bizarre. And guess what? They don't say it because of our buildings. And they don't say it because of entertainment. They say it because we love people we're not supposed to love. Have you thought about people here you're not supposed to love? Is it the prostitute on the other side of state line? Is it maybe the Mexican community that's serving in the restaurants and the hotels? Are there other lines that you're not supposed to cross? That good, stable people of the right mindset as a good American is, a good middle class people who think the right way, we're not supposed to talk to these people, we're not supposed to interact with them. After all, they're dirty and they're not like me. No, they're not. But God loves them as much as he loves me or anybody else in this room. This is what the early church was willing to do. The early church brought together Romans and Greeks and Jews and Persians and Egyptians and Gauls and all these other people and made them into one body. Oh, there were struggles for sure. You can read it all over the New Testament just between the ethnos, the Gentiles and the Jews. That was a huge divide. But so were all these other fights. The early church reached out across these lines. They loved people. It seems to me that they did exactly what Jesus called us to do. If you combine John 13:35, all men will see that you are my disciples by your buildings for one another. No. By your love for one another. With the Good Samaritan story, that God has called you to love and serve the person in your midst, that's who your neighbor is. It seems to be if you combine these thoughts and you have a good handle of what the early church was doing. See, this is not pragmatic in the sense that I just look for what works. It's principled. And then we look at what Jesus has taught us. And we fall back on what no Christian can offer. And that is the love of Jesus Christ has worked out in this world. This will open doors that you cannot imagine. I wish I had brought an email with you. I have an email from one of my professors at the University of Denver. Hates the church with every ounce of his being. And when he defines the church, it's Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, fill in the blank. And he writes me an email about 3 years ago. This is one of my committee members. Because they throw the kids out at 15 or 16. Into the streets. They have no education, no money, no family. That's it. So guess what happens? So anyways, we go there, and 119 kids in about 1,200 square feet. Our daughter had 21 other girls she was sharing about 14 by 16 bedroom with. 11 pallets filled up the entire room. The girls slept head-to-head on the pallets. Gabe was in a long dorm room, and there was just kids everywhere. And those were the lucky ones, because you see so many kids in the streets of Manila that have nobody. We saw kids at 2 at night driving through downtown. Kids all over the place with nothing, no homes or anything. Kids in the orphanage were blessed. And we came in, and they were taking pictures of the kids. The workers were there. It was a big thing because two of the kids. And Gabe and Rose were the two oldest kids in the orphanage. And we wanted that because those are the hard ones to adopt. And we wanted to keep the sibling pairs together. And so what happened was they took pictures of them with their friends. And then at one point, this other couple of kids, and their names were Dan and Julie, and they were Gabe and Rose's closest friends. And they came up to our social worker, and they were saying something in Tagalog. I have no idea what they're saying. And then she looks at me with this pained expression, and I said, well, what did they say? And she goes, they said, you took our pictures the same day you took Gabe and Rose's. Where's our parents? Guys, that kicked me like nothing ever has. It just would not leave me alone. If you can go to those places and not be moved, you are a robot. A tree, something. And this is where I think God's heart is take care of people who are in need. To take care of the widow, to take care of the orphan. Imagine how our culture would look at us if instead of spending our money that way, we were in fact emptying orphanages. Imagine how moved they would be, because they want to know, what the heck are you doing? Because guess what? They're not wondering what the heck we're doing right now. And they should be. They ought to see something so radically different. There was on the other end of this, there was a situation several years ago in Texas, and if you're somebody from Texas, you'll know what I mean. There was a woman in an old folks' home who was killed. How did she die? She was stung by fire ants. If you've ever been down to Texas, you know what a fire ant is. She'd been stung 800 times. I've been stung a couple times. I can't tell you how much that hurts. I can't imagine how many times she screamed before she passed out. You know what? You can't pay a person minimum wage and expect them to love an older person who's been abandoned in an old folks' home. See, this is where I think God's heart is, and that's why he says it over and over again, to take care of those who have been abandoned, whether it's on the older end or the younger end. And guess what? People ask questions then. And then you have the right to start talking about what Jesus has done to you and how God's heart is toward adoption, and how God's heart is towards the defenseless. This is what the early church did, and is my invitation to you, as my fellow American Christians, that this can be turned around in our culture as well, that we can make an impact on our neighbors. All right? Pagans, just pagans. Well, why are they suffering? That's their karma. Get over it, dude. No, I'm not going to get over it. I'm going to go love that person. That's what God has called us all to do. And that's my invitation to you.